Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Shares for beginners.
And I tell the story of there was a professor 3,000 kilometers away in Colorado who was particularly shocked because it was a guy called Professor Stephen Greenspan who had just published a book on avoiding scams. And what shocked him when it was the fact that he was actually invested in Bernie Madoff, his scheme. And so with great humor, he wrote an article later saying how I got scammed by Bernie Madoff. So it's, and I throw that story in because it just shows that as humans, we are vulnerable to these things, even the people that are experts on it.
G'day and welcome back to Shares for Beginners. I'm Phil Muscatello. My guest today believes that the tools and levers to enable personal finance have never been better, simpler, cheaper, or more accessible, which we cover a lot here on the podcast, and we just wanted to hammer that point home. Particularly here in Australia. G'day, David. Welcome to the podcast.
G'day, Phil. Good to be here.
So David Scollin has spent 25 years in the finance industry and recognises the challenges people face with personal money management. He's just published his book, Mission Possible, Four Steps to Financial Independence on Any Income. But we also just wanted to focus a little bit about your day job, because like all of us, we've got a day job as well, and you're an asset consultant with JANA. JANA, is that how it's pronounced?
That's right.
JANA Investment Advisors. So tell us, what's an asset consultant do?
An asset consultant basically helps the big institutions that are investing money on behalf of millions of people. So like insurance companies, super funds, charities, endowments.
Yeah.
And we help them with everything to do with the investing side. So just like a financial planner helps an individual or mums and dads, asset consultants help the big institutions that are investing money and across lots of different things. So regarding different asset classes, where to be investing the money within the asset classes, different managers, and also thematics like sustainability and regulation. So, so it's interesting. So interestingly, I've been in both the institutional world now, but I've also been in the retail world initially as a financial planner. Which has really helped form the book.
So this is like a financial planner for big institutions. Is that kind of how it works?
Yeah, exactly. In a way, yeah, except with a focus on the investing side.
When I think of asset consulting, I kind of think, well, it seems to imply in my mind that it's asset allocation and also definition of those assets. Well, I'm assuming you don't need to define those the assets to the big institutions. But is it like allocation? Which part of the funds are going to be allocated where?
Yeah. So that's a big element. So we call it like one acronym is Strategic Asset Allocation, so SAA. Mm-hmm. And that's where, you know, of course, across all the different asset classes like, you know, equity, so global and Australian equities, property, infrastructure, fixed income, private equity, currency. So we help the institutions look at their SAA and different allocations over time and how to be adjusting.
On behalf of people who are most probably listening to this podcast as well.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So the end beneficiaries of our clients are just everyday people in the street.
Mm-hmm. So tell us about the book and how it's going. You've had some good feedback, I believe.
Yeah, you know, the book's been great. It's a really interesting process to go through writing a book as someone who had never thought of writing one. But, you know, I spoke to my boss a couple of years ago and just said how I would like to have a shot at it. Just knowing the challenges regarding personal finance and having both retail and the institutional side, and you learn from both sides. And I guess being really, frustrated in some cases and sad in some cases, seeing, you know, people being pushed down the wrong direction through bad information, or some people being scammed. And I thought, well, rather than sort of just whinge about it, and complain, do something about it. And I thought a book's the right medium in terms of being a nice balance. It's a few hours read for a lifelong topic, an important topic, and a good balance between, you know, a 30-second TikTok video and years of formal study. So so that's why I wrote the book.
Yeah. So, look, I didn't actually put this in the questions, but I forgot to ask, and I want to ask you, is about your running career and especially altitude running and what you did in the Sydney Olympics. Just quickly go through that for us, please. That's because it's a great story.
Yeah, sure. I mean, the book kicks off at 2,400 metres altitude in the Rift Valley and talks about the Kalenjin people in the Rift Valley in Kenya, where you have arguably the most concentrated source of elite athletes in the world. In this case, middle distance running. And I tell the story because it's a good lesson in terms of, you know, realizing that things like, well, sport comes down to balancing a few factors rather than trying to find the secret to one, you know, one secret. And likewise with when it comes to personal finance and financial independence, rather than relying on one secret thing like just being an investment guru or just earning a big income or saving everything you've got, it's actually a balance of lots of things. Mm. Now, and that's where your question about my sporting career, and I use that word carefully, but I got there because I had this sort of challenge. I gave this challenge to myself to try and get to the Olympics. And I want to be super clear. I actually didn't get there, but I remember being in the Circuit of the Key when the Sydney Olympics was announced. And I thought it was 7 years. So it was 1993. And I thought, I'm going to go for, you know, I've got 7 years to train for it. I'll catch the bus out to the final if I get there. And I went on this challenge and fell short. I went to the trials 4 weeks before the Olympics started. But it was an amazing journey and included getting to the Rift Valley and training at the national training camp with the Kenyans.
Yeah. There's plenty of sporting analogies in this business, isn't there?
Yeah.
So let's go through the four steps. Take us through the four steps of the book.
Yeah, so I mean, the subtitle of the book is, you know, Four Steps to Financial Independence. So the four steps are earn more than you spend and then invest the rest well over time.
That's not spend less than you earn?
No.
Yeah, I know. That's a subtle difference, isn't it?
Yeah. I wanted to be, you know, it's more positive in terms of just if you really want to spend, just make sure you're earning more than what you're spending.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, I derailed you there.
Yeah, no problem. And then step three is plan for property. Which, you know, I wish it wasn't there, but in Australia, just the nature of the property market here and the cost of it, that we do need to plan for it. And then step four is cover risks, which sounds a bit boring, but you can do all the best things in the world, but if something unexpected happens, it can bring your whole work and effort undone. So that's why I cover that. Mm. And, you know, I call it the world's shortest and simplest financial plan, you know, because it's so short, 16 words. And happy to go through the steps or, you know, as you see fit.
Yeah, let's go through the steps one by one.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So earn more than you spend. Well, you got to include earning because that's our ability to earn is our biggest asset. Our biggest lifetime asset is our ability to earn income.
Because in the book, you actually describe how much you are worth as an asset, and most people don't think of themselves as an asset class, really, do they?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit corny way to look at things. But, you know, from a finance perspective, we forget that, you know, when we start out and, you know, we leave home and we're starting out and we feel like we're at our poorest and we forget that we have the biggest asset, the ability to earn an income. And it's pretty powerful and it's worth millions. And the book goes through why it's worth millions. And it's just important to be utilizing. So, you know, kicking off earning a good income. I talk about, you know, I like the ideal of, you know, doing something we love and you never work a day of your life. But initially, sometimes you just got to take, you know, whatever jobs that are coming to kickstart that earning ability. And then step one, part of it is, you know, earn more than you spend. And that's important because you need to be, while we can earn now, there comes a state, we call it human capital or sweat capital, our ability to earn. But the reality is that at some stage, we can no longer sweat. Meaning that people don't want our sweat because we're not adding value that people want later on in life. We may not want to sweat. Our sweat may no longer be valuable. And so we just need to diversify away from our reliance on earning. And that's why we need to be saving a little bit. So spending less than we earn. And then the second step is funneling that savings into investments. And there's a distinction there because it's invest well. And the book goes through investing well as opposed to just investing. And then the other important element is over time. because you know, investing well over a month is fantastic, but it's a little consequence. We just need to string, you know, year after year after year, which is doable, absolutely doable, but we need to do that over time because that's when the big advantages kick in. Step three, you know, I mentioned it. I wish it wasn't there, planning for property, but in Australia, we do need to plan for it. And there's a lot of, there's actually some good tools out there in terms of to help us. You know, there's lots of different government initiatives. Even in the last budget, there was some, you know, a lot of focus on you know, making affordable housing, which they, the government realized they need to put a lot more effort into that. And then step four, as I mentioned, covering risks. So there's two elements of that, the covering risks. There's a short, smaller risk that can happen, like when we least expect it. It could be a broken down car, or we've got to replace computers or fridges and stuff like that. And we need to be ready for those, so through emergency funds. And then there's the bigger risk that can have long-term impact, like, you know, not being able to work earlier while we've still got career in us. And that can be really devastating. So, and then also insuring big assets as well, because big expenses can absolutely throw your financial planning out. And hence the chapter on that. And then the book wraps up with the fifth section, which just brings it all together and talks a little bit more about sort of, I guess, the mindset as well around money.
So this is the kind of thing that someone going to a financial planner would be discussing, or hopefully would be discussing with a financial planner. But do you believe that they're actually getting this kind of good distilled wisdom, or are they just looking for an answer and say, okay, well, we'll just hand everything over to you, look after us?
Yeah, great question. Do you know, there's a few things in that. Firstly, you know, advice is great, but it's going to be harder to come by because a lot of advisors have left the industry for all different reasons.
I can't believe it. So I think it's less than 15,000 advisors for the whole of Australia.
Yeah,
at this,
it's about
point
that
in
number.
Time.
Yeah. I mean, I know a lot of advisors, and you know, they've got waiting lists, and they just can't see everyone. So the book, in a way, prepares people for later in life when they need, you know, things are more complicated and they want to go and see a planner. In some ways, the book sets them up so that when they see a planner, that the planner doesn't have to go and deal with the more fundamental things, you know, that you're aware of what you're spending, you know, you're aware of what where your super is. And I liken it to a Sherpa. Like, you know, if you're climbing to Everest and you're starting from sea level, initially you don't need a Sherpa. I mean, you just do the work yourself. You do, you know, you read the book and you do the work yourself. And at some stage, things become more complicated or difficult and you need a guide in an advisor, but you don't necessarily need it the whole way.
You had to get permission from friends of the podcast, Warren and Charlie. We know who we're talking about there. Is that for quotes in the book? Was that why you had to get in touch, or what was the story?
Yeah. Do you know, I was a total novice to writing a book, but the rules in Australia, the copyright rules are really strict relative to some other countries.
Yeah.
And so you need to write out to every person, get permission, and in a certain format to get permission.
Mm-hmm.
And I got, it was about, you know, over 20 to write out to, Gloria Steinem, Jim Carrey, the producer of Kenny, and also Warren and Charlie. I could get through everyone through either social media or get their email address, but you can't get Warren and Charlie's. In fact, if any of your audience want to go and check out Berkshire Hathaway's website, it's something like something from the 90s. And I just couldn't find an email address. So I found the address in Omaha, Nebraska. And so I had to go and get a stamp, an old school, you know, snail mail, and write out. And it was during COVID and I didn't know if I'm going to hear back from them. But I got an email from Warren's assistant, who was lovely, and we sorted Warren out. But I was told that I need to write a personal letter to Charlie, who's in California.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I said, listen, can you give me an email address? Otherwise, this is going to take months going back and forth. And finally,
you should have had some copy paper in between and when you were typing it out.
Yeah.
So you could have two copies at once, you know,
the old
copy and paste.
Yeah, my old typewriter.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
But so finally got permissions, and Joe, the person I couldn't get was Jim Carrey. Couldn't track him down, and I'd love to, and I'm still on the hunt. So watch out, Jim.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
So you focus on some of the mistaken beliefs that hold people back. What are the three common investing fallacies?
Yeah, so I include, there's a whole chapter on Invest 101, which deals with the fallacies. And I threw them in because I've mentioned that investing is such an important element.
Mm-hmm.
And so the three, and I wanted to ensure that anyone that didn't feel comfortable wasn't investing to get over some of the typical misunderstandings. Yep. And it's the first one is investing is easy. And I use Charlie Munger's quote. He's got a great quote. He's in his late 90s now and you know, Warren Buffett's partner. And he's a pretty blunt sort of person. And he said, the quote is, you know, anyone that thinks investing is easy is stupid. And I put that out there because it's arguably the most competitive field in the world. And maybe your audience can write in and, you know, test that and suggest other competitive fields. But, you know, from what I get to see these smarts that come and visit in our office, because investing attracts the smarts, you know, money attracts smarts. Mm. It's a real challenge and an intellectual challenge. And so it attracts lots of smart people. And I wanted to, I guess, put that in there. I use the analogy, it's like getting on a horse, thinking it's a docile Shetland pony, but you're getting on a wild Brumby.
Mm-hmm.
And wild Brumbies can be great. They can take you long distances. It can be a hell of a ride. But if you're thinking you're getting on a Shetland pony, you're going to be thrown off straight away and it could be a lifelong injury and you'll never get back on. So I wanted to deal with that fallacy. The second is that investing is not for me. And I throw in lots of different excuses that people have, like, I don't have the background, I don't have the smarts, it's too complicated, it's too confusing, it's too boring.
It's only for rich people.
It's only for rich people. Mm-hmm. And I try to think of everything, because we happen to live in a time when the excuse is no longer irrelevant and we can throw out a lot of the complexity. So it doesn't matter about your background, you can invest. In fact, people are investing through their super. And then the third one is that investing is too hard. And I want to deal with that because, to my earlier point, that we live in a time where you can throw away a lot of the complexity. And so investing is more accessible. And I think your opening line, you know, that I mentioned is more accessible, never been cheaper, more accessible, easier and more effective.
So someone coming to markets for the first time or coming to investing for the first time, where would you suggest they start, especially if they haven't got a lot of money?
Yeah, well, and I want to, it's interesting what you said in coming to investments for the first time. One thing I want to point out, because I spoke to a lot of young people who had read the book and a lot of them said, oh, we're not investors. And I said, well, are you in superannuation? And they were. And I said, well, you're an investor. And I make that point clearly because people can spend, you know, years thinking I'm not an investor when they are. And it's interesting that we're in a situation because of the Australian super system that teenagers who are working and starting to earn super are often accessing a far more sophisticated investor than often their parents or even so-called sophisticated investors, like the formal definition of a sophisticated investor. And the amazing thing is that neither the teenager, the parents, or the sophisticated investors actually know this. And so just wanted to throw that out there.
No, it's actually a good point because that's the thing, is we are all investors, and it's good to look at super that way, because I think it just changes your mindset when you realize, well, okay, maybe I am an investor, and that's what a lot of people just need, to have that little switch thrown.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, people go, oh, I'm not invested in property. Well, actually, you are through super. I'm not invested in blockchain technology. Well, you are through super, because a lot of the big organizations are taking on this, using this technology. Some are invested in some form of private equity that we as individuals could never access. We're invested in infrastructure projects that none of us could access. Even the wealthiest individuals in Australia couldn't access. And
I think it's also valuable for them to understand that these are what are called asset classes and what these asset classes mean. And, you know, hopefully they will move not in tandem with each other during market ups and downs.
Yeah. And that's the job of the portfolio managers and the chief investment officers, to be working all that complexity out on our behalf.
Mm-hmm.
And I meet these people and they're super smart.
And you're consulting with them as well.
Yeah, I am. Yeah. And, you know, we get to see the smarts, which is a real advantage, you know, that to have comfort of how that is being invested, accessing stuff that I can't as an individual access. But there's also a chapter, investing outside of super. You know, these days we've got to be careful in terms of pushing people in certain product directions.
Yeah.
But I go through the different main investment classes and talk about ETFs in terms of, you asked about the starting point. You know, ETFs is an innovation that people from a few generations ago couldn't have even imagined.
Mm.
And it's allowing us to access thousands of different investments and not having to do any of the research, all the complexity is taken care of by the provider, and we access it for a few cents every $100. And you may have spoken on podcasts about the core satellite concept, where you know you have a core investment, and then outside of that, if you want to, you don't have to, you have your little investments. So going back to your question, a core outside of super ETFs, everyone would advocate. Anyone with good knowledge advocates it. Warren Buffett, he says,
unless certain types of ETFs. Let's be clear about this.
Yeah, thanks, Phil. So I'm talking about index ETFs as a core. Mm. So index ETFs, the reason why I say that is there's transparency. You know what you're investing in, and they're well-known providers that are reliable. And so, good distinction. But, Warren Buffett talks about it. If you're not interested, unless you're super interested in Berkshire Hathaway, he keeps saying index ETFs.
So I love the part about Sir Isaac Newton. I'm a big fan of physics, and he was the inventor, I guess. He defined classical physics, and he revolutionized optics. But he was a good investor. He was also he was a tax collector as well.
Didn't know that.
Yeah, apparently, if you look into Isaac Newton, he loved collecting taxes. I mean, and he was an alchemist as well. So,
an interesting character.
An interesting character. But he was a good investor, and then he wasn't a good investor. Tell us that story.
Yeah. I threw that in there because, we know him as being a pretty smart guy. I think he's rated he's top five smartest of all time. But he excelled in the field of physics, where there's reliable rules in physics. And then when you switch into investing, there's not fully reliable rules because it's a chaotic system, because humans are involved. And when humans are involved, there's emotion. And so while he had his IQ, very high IQ, he wasn't prepared on the emotional side, I think, with the investing. I didn't get to interview him on it. But he, there's this great story about the South Sea Company. So in the early 1700s, where it received so much attention. It wasn't earning any revenue, but there was a real mania about it because of the opportunity down the track. And he invested in it, and he saw that people were just pushing the price up, and he got out. And he made 100% profit, so millions apparently in today's dollars. Mm. And then he watched it continue to go up higher and higher. And he had this massive dose of FOMO, of missing out. And so he got back in. And he got back in at the peak, and then it just collapsed. And he lost all his original money, all profits, and it absolutely totally upset him. Apparently, no one could mention South Sea Company in his in his presence. And it's where I think the phrase came, or his supposed quote was that, he can calculate the movements of heavenly bodies, of stars, but he can't calculate the madness of people. And so it scarred him for the rest of his life, that one investment.
So this kind of leads into compounding, really, because you describe it as the most powerful force in the universe, or others have called it the most powerful force in the universe. So tell us about compounding.
Yeah. So I throw that in as well, because it is such an important element to investing. And the interesting thing about compounding is it's just not intuitive. Like for even the smartest of people, it's not intuitive because of its power. And when we talk about compounding, we're referring to, on a finance sense, the earning of on your principal, on your original investment, earnings on that, plus earnings on the principal and the earnings year after year after year, which compounds and becomes, the most powerful force in the universe. Mm. And, I tell a story about a king and a servant and a chessboard and a grain of wheat. And it tells a story about how the servant saved the king's son's, only his son's life. And the king was eternally grateful and said, you can have whatever reward you want for saving my son's life. And this servant, pretty cluey guy, he thought he was suspicious about the king's ability to actually back up on and agree to a request. So he said, listen, all I want is a chessboard and some wheat to fill the chessboard with wheat. And the king thought, well, what a foolish servant I've got. No wonder I'm king and he's a servant. Mm-hmm. And he said, absolutely, I'll deliver on your request. So he handed it over. And the servant said, no, I want you to fill it out. All I want you to do is put a grain of wheat on the first square and double every subsequent squares over the 64 squares. And the king said, sure. He got another servant to dish it out. And the king was thinking, how foolish my servant. But then at some stage into the fourth row or the fifth row, he started to realize, actually, this is going to be a lot of wheat. And then he realized there's not enough wheat in his whole kingdom to deliver on this request. And the figures are, so it's the total grains of wheat is 16,500 quadrillion grains of wheat. So a 20-digit figure. And it just it's a story that exemplifies that it's not obvious. And I related the 64 squares to our long-term investing. And that if you've been investing for the first row for the first 8 years, it's not going to feel significant. It's guaranteed not to feel significant, even in the next 8 years, even the next. And so just be patient with it, put the money in and let it do its work. And to really try and dissuade people from getting frustrated and starting off afresh on square one, just let it do its work and the magic kicks in.
So have you got any stories? The book's full of lots of great stories and anecdotes. Share a couple of your favourite ones.
Yeah, I mean, I threw lots just to, you know, personal finance can be sometimes dull, but actually there's heaps of amazing stories when it comes to money. And we're actually seeing a lot of them pop up in, you know, in documentaries and series on Netflix. You know, you got the Tindler Swindler, the Fire Festival that never happened, Anna Sorokin of inventing Anna Fame. So there's lots of great stories and I threw some of them in the book. One of the interesting ones was, I speak about scams and how to, you know, try and avoid them. And I talk about the original Charles Ponzi, but also the biggest Ponzi scheme of all time, which concerned Bernie Madoff. It's an amazing story because Bernie Madoff was, you know, hugely respected in the finance industry. And people were stumbling over to give him money. But it was, as we all know now, it was the biggest Ponzi scheme of all time. So, you know, he's taking money from new people and giving it back to existing investors to keep the scheme going. He told his sons, who didn't even know about it, they worked in the business, they didn't know about it. And they were obliged to actually tell on him. So the FBI picked him up. And the New York and the finance industry were totally shocked that this guy was scheming. And I tell the story of there was a professor 3,000 kilometers away in Colorado who was particularly shocked because it was a guy called Professor Stephen Greenspan who had just published a book on avoiding scams. And what shocked him was the fact that he was actually invested in Bernie Madoff, his scheme. And so with great humor, he wrote an article later saying how I got scammed by Bernie Madoff. I throw that story in because it just shows that, you know, as humans, we are vulnerable to these things, even the people that are experts on it. And so I just, you know, really try and get people to exercise caution and have a bit of a framework around how to do that.
So you've got some pretty heavyweight testimonials for the book. And how did you get Howard Marks, Morgan Housel and William Bernstein, who are like, what, Djokovic, Federer and Nadal, recommending a tennis player? So how did you go about getting those sort of testimonials?
There's some in the financing world. They're not necessarily well-known household figures, but in the financing writing world, you know, they're big figures in the US. And I just reached out to them through social media. For Morgan Housel and William Bernstein, and I just sent them the first 500 words, and they must have enough inquisitive minds where they read it and they thought this is interesting. And they were happy to look at it and wrote some lovely words. And Howard Marks did a personal video as well. And he wrote some long feedback. It was really touching because, you know, as you say, it's like getting Federer, Nadal and Djokovic to have a look at your poor tennis form. and so it was nice.
Yeah. So what did they say? Just tell us one of the nice things.
Yeah. I mean, I think, on the front of the book is from Howard Marks, you know, everyone can benefit from reading this book.
Great testimonial.
yeah, that's why it's on the front. I mean, it's funny. There's another Howard Marks who's Mr. Nice. So some people are familiar with.
I read the book. I remember reading the book years ago.
yeah. Sadly, he's no longer with us, so I couldn't get his testimonial.
It's not quite the business we all want to be in.
No, people can search that one up. But not everyone knows about Howard, but, you know, he actually, Warren Buffett's written only two testimonials for people, Jack Bogle and Howard Marks for their books. So it had to go to the front.
So how can listeners find out more about you and about the book? And I guess it's available in all good bookstores.
Yeah. So you can access it on normal, you know, Amazon and Booktopia and the like. There's also, you can access it if you want a signed copy through the actual book's website, so missionpossiblebook.com.au. Mm-hmm. If you want to stay in touch, there's a newsletter. I only do it once a month. I just think there's so much noise out there. I try and keep it short and just once a month for those that want to follow. And you know, I can leave a discount code for listeners if they want a discount on a signed copy.
Oh, okay. Can you tell us that now, the discount code, or do you need to work it out?
So for anyone that wants to access a signed copy of the book, they can go to the website, missionpossiblebook.com.au. And if they'd like a discount, you can put in the discount code early discount, one word.
Yep, and we'll put all those links in the episode notes and the blog post as well, so you can find them a lot easier. David Scullin, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thanks, Phil. It's been really great to speak to you.
If you found this podcast helpful, please tell a friend, especially if it's someone who needs to start thinking about investing for their future. You'll be helping them and helping me to keep this show on the road.
Shares for Beginners is for information and educational purposes only. It isn't financial advice, and you shouldn't buy or sell any investments based on what you've heard here. Any opinion or commentary is the view of the speaker only, not Shares for Beginners. This podcast doesn't replace professional advice regarding your personal financial needs, circumstances, or current situation.
And thank you for listening to my podcast.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.